Well, here's my teaser for the message this morning. Would you all like to know what the secret of life is?
Yes!
Yes! I am so glad someone got that reference. 42. Yeah, it's one thing if you watch City Slickers. It's 42 if you watch The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. James Taylor had a song that I just loved. It was called The Secret of Life. And he said the secret of life was enjoying the passage of time. And that's not bad. Well, I think Jesus gave us a secret to life as well. And we're going to talk about his calling of Levi this morning. And we're going to kind of move up to what I hope will be the secret of life in your minds, you know. We've been doing a red letter study here. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, this is actually 17 of these installments. But we're just going through at our leisure. We're going to break for Easter and do something completely different, of course. But we'll get back to this. Just going through the words of Jesus, the ones that are usually printed in red, at least in some Bibles, because it is so amazing what he has to say. But the shock, sometimes the bewilderment, and the power of Jesus' words are lost when they've been translated in English for as long as they have, and we've grown so familiar with them that they cease to do the job that they were supposed to do, which is to really to wrench us out of comfortable and familiar patterns and into new places that we haven't really even contemplated going. This is what Jesus was doing constantly, shaking things up, getting people to see things from a different point of view. Because it's only with that different point of view that we finally start to break through what we think we know, what we think we believe, that is only serving now to become the barrier to that pure presence that Jesus calls kingdom. So here we are. We've been going through a series of healings and miraculous signs, and we've been realizing that the theme of everything that Jesus has been doing over these last few weeks of his ministry, from preaching on the shores of Galilee and taking the disciples out to deeper water and showing them there a miraculous catch of fish when they couldn't catch any on their own, to healing a leper, to healing a paralytic, and now immediately coming off of that story of the paralytic being lowered down through a hole that they tore in the roof and healed there by Jesus, he goes out from that place and he comes to another place right along the shore of the Sea of Galilee, along the main highway, where there's a toll booth there, a tax booth. And the man sitting there, he calls him. And this is Levi. And so we're going to talk about how all of these stories are parallel. All these stories connect in a very real way. And the themes that Jesus is talking about continue to persist as he goes through these different connections with these different people. There's huge parallel between Levi, the tax collector, being called, and the healing of the paralytic. Because if you think about it, both of them were outcasts. Both of them were singled out, picked out of a crowd of people. The only ones singled out in this particular instance to come into a deeper place, to come into deeper water. They were outcasts. Of course, the paralytic, and we talked about this in Hebrew culture, anytime someone was less than optimal, if you were sick, if you were paralyzed, if you had any type of skin disease like the leper did, you were outcast. You couldn't do the things that you were designed to do. You couldn't be in community. You were unclean. And until there was some sort of healing, there couldn't be restoration. There couldn't be the acceptance back into community. You literally had to stand outside the city gates in many instances. And you couldn't come in until the priest declared you clean. Jesus takes that and turns it around. He touches the leper before he's healed, making himself ritually unclean. He doesn't care. It's all about the connection. Jesus accepts before the healing, before the restoration, before the amends or restitution, before anything is fixed, Jesus is there to touch and connect and to heal with the leper, with the paralytic. He comes down out of the roof, and obviously looking for physical healing. And the first thing Jesus says is, your sins are forgiven, son. Recognizing the fact that his faith has already taken him to that place that brought him into his presence. And now with Levi, the same thing is happening. Levi was a tax collector. How many of you really like tax collectors? You know, It's one thing in our culture to like the tax man or to hate the tax man, but in that culture it meant something entirely different. Under the occupation of Rome was a brutal place to be. The countries, the civilizations that had fallen under Rome's dominion were, in many ways, they were left to their own devices, but then they were constantly being bled of resources. Rome was a black hole. With this vast empire, they needed so many resources. It was all about the taxes. It was all about getting as much as they could out of their provinces so they could keep the whole machine running. And the taxes were terrible. They were usurious, you know, kind of the direction we seem to be heading. But it was difficult. And, you know, it's amazing. We tend to think of the ancients as being kind of primitive, as being in another sort of category. But when you look at their civilizations and you look at the sophistication of their thought and their practices, they are exactly the same as us. The only difference was technology. They had bows and arrows, and we've got laser-guided missiles. But the rest of it is exactly the same. Their tax system was sophisticated, it was complicated, and it was usurious. What they actually did in the provinces was that the Roman officials would sell, would like almost franchise out, if you want to think of it that way. Like you'd buy a McDonald's franchise. You could buy, if you had enough money, a franchise to be a chief tax collector. In the gospel, Zacchaeus is most likely one of those chief tax collectors. He's the guy at the top. He's the guy that connects directly with Rome. He paid the money. He paid the dues. He got a province. He got a district within which to work and to collect taxes. And then he would hire people out to actually do the collecting. And there were two types of taxes. There were direct taxes and indirect taxes. The direct taxes were like income taxes and property taxes, real estate taxes. And there were gabai. They were called gabai that were hired by the chief tax collector to collect all those sorts of taxes. And then there were indirect taxes. They were taxes on commerce, taxes on trade, taxes on market fees. And so people who were transporting goods to and from had to pay taxes. You know, kind of like the way stations along the freeway. The trucks have to pull off and they have to pay a fee per axle. This is what went on. And so this group of people, these folks, the Marques, they were the ones who were hired to be the indirect tax collectors. They were the ones who sat at the toll booths, and as the caravans came by, they would stop them. And they were hated by the tradesmen, you know, because it was inconvenient, but also because they would go through every little piece and item in the caravan's load to extract the maximum amount of taxes. Literally, sometimes these trademen had to unload everything off of every camel, out of every cart, and lay it all out along the road so they could assess and calculate and do their things. And you can imagine the amount of difficulty if you are hitting toll booth after toll booth and having to unload and reload and pay and pay. And a lot of these guys were dishonest, extracting more than they were supposed to. And if that wasn't enough, just within the Jewish psyche, it reminded them of the dominion of Rome, this hated oppressor. 400 years of foreign domination, when the promise to Abraham was supposed to be that Israel was going to be a sovereign light to the other nations, and that Abraham was going to be a father to a multitude of nations that was more numerous than the sands on the beach. And here's Rome extracting these taxes, using their own people to do so. These tax collectors were on a par with the harlots, with the prostitutes, with the gamblers, with the drunkards, with the scum of society. Rabbinical teachings that are contemporary with the Gospels and later on tell that they were basically beasts in human form. They were licensed robbers. They were unclean. Their money was tainted. You couldn't take money from them without being defiled yourself. Do you start to get the picture of the outcast nature of Levi's life? He couldn't have commerce with anybody who saw themselves as standing within the law. Nobody would have anything to do with them. You couldn't have a meal with them. You couldn't talk in the streets. You couldn't even buy and sell. You would have to go outside into the Greek parts of town in order to have any sort of commerce and connection. They didn't care. But with the Jews, with their own people, they could not connect. And here's Jesus walking by the tax booth. And let's read what happens here. Is Jesus doing his thing once again? If you have your books, go ahead and go to Mark 2, Verse 13, otherwise look up on the screens or look in your bulletins. What we're going to do is there are parallel passages in Mark, Matthew, and Luke. And I want to pick up threads from all three Gospels because there's little details here that get added in one Gospel and not another. I want to catch them all as we go through. At Mark 2:13, and he went out again by the seashore, and all the people were coming to him, and he was teaching them. And as he passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting in the tax booth. And he said to him, "Follow me." And he got up and followed him. But look at Matthew 9:9. As Jesus went out from there, he saw a man called Matthew sitting in the tax collector's booth. And he said to him, "Follow me." And he got up and followed him. So who are we talking about here? Is this Levi or is this Matthew? Which is it? You know, we would normally just say simply, well, you know, it's the same guy. It's the same story. It's the same details. But in this case, it's not quite so simple, you know. And this may not have anything to do with anything except just to tell you that, you know, here in Mark's gospel, the man is described as Levi, son of Alphaeus. In Luke's gospel, it's just Levi. And in Matthew's gospel, it's Matthew. And so scholars have wondered, which is it? Levi is not listed as one of the 12 apostles in the list of apostles in Matthew 10. But there is a James, son of Alphaeus. So is Levi the same as James? Or is Levi James' brother, both the son of Alphaeus? You know, Matthew is listed there. And so is Levi the same as Matthew? Most scholars have agreed that it's probably Matthew, but we don't really know for sure. And the only reason I bring this up is that some of the things that we take so easily for granted as we read through Scripture have been the source of centuries of debate and consternation and people trying to figure out and poring over so many different manuscripts trying to find answers. Does it really matter in the end? I don't think so. There was a man who was completely outcast, who made his living off the backs of the people, and Jesus accepted him without condition. Follow me. Sight unseen. Now, Jesus was all over that area. Capernaum was his hometown. He probably lived with Peter, or maybe he had a home of his own. We don't really know for sure. So he had probably passed Levi many times along the road, seen him, observed him, maybe realized that he was ready. He was right there. All he needed was the little nudge, the push, to go out into deeper water. And he does. He left everything behind, Luke says, and got up and began to follow him. In the other two Gospels, they just simply say that he arose. He got up. But the interesting thing about that word, it's the same word that's used for Jesus when he arose on Easter Sunday. So there's layers of meaning here. Yeah, he literally got up and followed Jesus, but he literally arose as well. He was literally resurrected out of who he was into something different as he took the step, followed the call. You know, we've always been coming back to this theme of the hero's journey. He answered the call to begin his own hero's journey. He arose. Something changed in there. You know? And then Levi gave a big reception for him in his house. And there was a great crowd of tax collectors and other people who were reclining at the table with them. This is in Luke 5. I know that detail is not in Mark that you're probably looking at right now. I put it in there because Mark doesn't say. Just says, and he was reclining at a table. Luke fills in the detail. Levi threw the party for Jesus, threw the reception at his house. Some scholars say, well, it doesn't say whose house. Was that Jesus' house? Was that Levi's house? That's getting into the weeds a little bit too much for me. He threw a party for him. Big crowd at the party, all reclining at table. They didn't sit, they reclined, they laid down at the table. Now, who was going to be in this crowd, in Levi's house? I'll tell you what, it's not going to be a Pharisee, it's not going to be a scribe, it's not going to be anybody who sees themselves as a self-respecting Jew. Why? Because they're unclean. You can't take food out of their hands, you can't take money out of their hands. You can't touch them without having them to go to the priest and be ritually cleansed. Jesus is in a house full of tax collectors, other tax collectors, friends of Levi, and anybody else who was willing to be unclean with them. This is a house full of people who stood outside the law. In Hebrew, it's Am Ha'aretz, which literally means people of the land, people who are not connected to the law. You know, this is who Jesus is sitting with. He and his disciples are in with all of these people, eating with them, drinking with them, which implies in that culture a pact, a treaty, a connection, a promise to be in relationship. And this is Jesus. And it happened that he was reclining at the table in the house with many tax collectors and sinners who were dining with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many of them, and they were following him. These horrible people, these scum of the earth, are some of the ones that have been following Jesus around town, jumping at the chance to actually have a meal with him. Jesus and his disciples. When the scribes of the Pharisees saw that he was eating with the sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, "Why is he eating and drinking with the tax collectors and sinners?" Now you notice, they don't ask Jesus directly, they ask the disciples. Is that just a cop-out? Well, no. Not maybe. Maybe they're afraid to ask the head guy. But more importantly, they're standing outside in the street because they're not going to go into that house. Jesus is in the house. They're talking to the people in the overflow on the outside, because to go inside that house would have been to defile themselves. Then they would have to go and become ritually cleansed. So they asked his disciples, "Why is he eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners?" But when Jesus heard this, he said, "It is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick." God, don't you love Jesus' metaphors and analogies? And he just comes up with the exact word picture that is so perfect. But go and learn what this means. This is from Matthew 9. It's not going to be. This is another detail. Go and learn what this means. I desire compassion and not sacrifice. That is a direct translation from Hosea 6:6. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. Compassion and not sacrifice. And then the second half of that quotation is, I delight in knowledge of God and not burnt offerings. Remember we talked about God's will, Sevyana, and what it really means in Aramaic is not will as we think of will, but desire, delight, pleasure, deepest purpose. This is the word that's being used here. I desire mercy and compassion. I delight in. My deepest purpose is mercy and compassion. My pleasure is mercy and compassion. And I also delight in knowledge of God and not burnt offerings. This is another instance of Jewish poetry, and we've talked about this. In Jewish poetry, you don't have successive same sounds, which we would call rhyme, or alliteration, or assonance, whether it's the beginning, middle, or end of a word. What you have in Jewish poetry is a repetition of the same concept. And so these words define each other. I desire mercy and not compassion. I desire knowledge of God and not burnt offerings. Those are parallel phrases. And so the first half of each one, you can put an equal sign between them. And the same thing with the second half. Burnt offerings and sacrifice, that's obvious. Okay? That stands for the letter of the law. That stands for the temple purity system. That stands for the religious practices that people believed were there to save them, that people believed were there to make them acceptable to God. And God is saying directly, that's not it. What I desire is mercy and compassion. What I desire is knowledge of God. So the knowledge of God is the same as mercy and compassion. Why? Because God is mercy. God is compassion. God is love. He is those things. To know God is to know, to delight, desire, and take pleasure in yourself, in mercy and compassion. Not about the system, the institution of the religion. If those institutions are driving us to the mercy and compassion, then they're good and they're doing their job. When they stand in the way, when they become an end in themselves, then they've lost, not only lost all of their meaning and purpose, they've also become a block to be able to ever get to where God and Jesus are trying to drive us. This is what he's telling them. You have gotten lost in the institution of your faith. However it started, however good it was at the beginning for you to try to separate yourselves off, to remain holy to your God, to put practices in place that reminded you daily of what this life was about. What it has become is a wall between you and the very people that you are here to connect with, without which connection there is no kingdom. You are literally subverting the pleasure and the desire and the delight of God now by the institutions that you practice. This is what Jesus is trying to get across to them. Do you see what's going on here? Back at Mark 2:17, and hearing this, Jesus says to them, "It is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. I did not come to call the righteous, but to call the sinners." Jesus is meeting these people at the point of their need. He doesn't require them to stop sinning. He doesn't require them to clean up their act before he goes to them to let them know that they are accepted and they are loved, which is all the impetus that any of us need then to stop sinning and to change what we are doing. But here's the thing. Because they are sinners, they are actually singled out. Jesus goes to them because they need his help. Not waiting for them to come to him once they've cleaned up. How is that even possible? But that's what our laws, that's what our institutions have brought us to. If we end up just following the letter too long, following the symbol too long and forgetting what the symbol was standing for in the first place. Jesus is taking this thing and wrenching it back around and trying to get us to see it from the point of view of his Father's eyes. As his Father sees each one of us, as he, Jesus, sees each one of the people in front of him. At the Last Supper, he said, "This new commandment I give you, just love each other as I have loved you." This is what he's doing. He does that every second of his day. He knows how he's loved by his Father, and he loves in the same way. Now he says, "You've seen how I love you in human form. Go and love the same way." That's going to take you to a place you've never been before. But you got to let go of certain things. This is the first of three illustrations that Jesus is giving us, or going to give us, you know, about how this works out in practice. Because now John's disciples come to Jesus along with the Pharisees, and this is John the Baptist's disciples. They come, and the Pharisees, we're fasting. John's disciples, the Pharisees are fasting, and they come to Jesus and they say to him, "Why do John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast?" Now you have to think about fasting here. Fasting is the body's natural reaction to grief. Right? When you're sad, when you're really upset, when you've lost something, you're really hungry, do you really want to eat? The body naturally shuts down at times of grief and at times of loss. And so fasting naturally became a ritualized reaction to grief. That we will fast, we will take this time, we will separate ourselves from the normal course of our lives in order to heighten awareness of what's going on and God's action in it. But once again, it's a beautiful thing, but you take it out a ways and the symbol becomes separated from the meaning behind the symbol, and now it becomes a superstitious sort of thing. The Pharisees fasted constantly, you know. They fasted because they wanted to obtain certain things. So they would fast in order to get them. They would fast in order to avoid certain things, like war or pestilence or famine. They'd fast if they wanted to bring rain, and they had ritualized ways of doing that. A 3-day fast if the rain didn't come by this month, and 3 more if it didn't come by that month. They had all these rules. They fasted twice a week, just regularly, as Pharisees. The whole nation of Israel had 4 major fasts during the year to celebrate 4 major catastrophes in the history of their nation. And then there were all these other fasts. They would fast so they would have a lucky dream. They would fast so that the evil in a dream was avoided. You know, they would fast for all sorts of things. And John's disciples were fasting too. "Why don't you fast? Why are you eating and drinking? Why are you a drunkard and a glutton?" They accuse him in another passage. And Jesus responds. Right here. "While the bridegroom is with them, the attendants of the bridegroom cannot fast, can they? So long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast. But the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in that day." This is the first of these three illustrations I was talking about. And of course, everybody knows what he's talking about because he's talking about the wedding custom. In Judaism, which of course we don't know anything about. And so, the power of what Jesus is trying to get across is lost or minimized. In that culture, when the bridegroom came to get the bride, it was a party. And they would have the actual marriage ceremony. And if it was a virgin bride, the marriage ceremony lasted for 7 full days. Imagine having house guests for 7 days, sleeping on the couch and everywhere around. And you had to feed them for 7 days. 7 days of fasting. If the bride was a widow, it was only 3 days. But still, that's a long time too. While the bridegroom is with them, the party goes on. When the bridegroom leaves with the bride to take her home, the party stops. Everybody knew this. Everybody understood exactly what Jesus was saying. You know, while I am here in this period, this is not the time for fasting. This is the time for celebration. That time will come. The loss will come in your life eventually. And then you can fast. But right now is a time for celebration. Jesus is pointing out a stark contrast between himself and the religious leaders of his day. They were severe. They were dour. You know, think of the Puritans in our culture. You know, those guys wearing all the black. You couldn't dance, you couldn't drink, you couldn't smile, you couldn't have any fun because any kind of sort of pleasure was going away from the suffering of Christ. These guys had, you know, had it all over the Puritans. It was the same way. They dressed severely. Their lives were severe. Everything was about following the law. Everything was about trying to figure out if you had broken the law. There was no fun. It was just a lot of hard work. Jesus is saying, I'm the bridegroom. This is the party. We have to start seeing Jesus like this image over here that many of you have commented on. I never saw a laughing Jesus before. Well, get used to it. That's who he is. Jesus laughed. He was going through his life with an arm draped around the shoulder of anybody near. He was the one who was bringing life into every community. The scriptures talk about him as teaching with authority. You know, his authority came from his genuineness. His authority came from leaving people better than he found them, making them feel good about themselves, making them laugh, making them smile. This was his characteristic. This is the way he lived his life. He said, you can't enter the kingdom unless you become like a child. Well, what do children do? If he could say that and he wasn't doing it himself, then he's a hypocrite. It means that Jesus was childlike himself. It means that when he played with kids, he didn't just sit them on his knee and pat their head and say, good kid. He was rolling around in the dirt with them, giving horseback rides. They're pulling his beard and squealing and laughing. This is the picture of Jesus that he's implying here. We got to read between the lines. We got to see what Jesus is saying here. He was called a drunkard and a glutton for a good reason, because he partied with people. Not in a dysfunctional sense, but in the best sense of celebration and connection. This is our Lord. This is Jesus. This is what he's trying to get across. And then he moves to the next illustration. No one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. Otherwise, the patch pulls away from it, and the new from the old, and a worse tear results. We all know this. You know, you get a new cotton shirt, pair of pants, whatever. First time you wash it, it's going to shrink 2 sizes. Yeah, I always remember back in the days when Levi's came pre-shrunk, unwashed. I mean, they used to be stiff as a board. You guys who are old enough, you remember that? You could pretty much lay them out and walk across a sawhorses with it. And you'd buy them 2 sizes too big because you knew that they were going to shrink down and then you might be able to get them to fit right. You know, now they pre-shrink them. But imagine taking that new pair of pants or a patch like that and putting it on an old pair of jeans. First time you wash it, that patch shrinks up, pulls away, and destroys the patch that you made. Again, another perfect example. Everybody knew this. Everybody understood exactly what he's saying. And then he adds the third one. No one puts new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the wine will burst the skins and the wine is lost, and the skins as well. But one puts new wine into fresh wineskins. Now, these wineskins were literally either the skins of animals sewn up tight to be watertight, or maybe a bladder of an internal organ or something. But they were skins. And after time, they stretched and they wore out. When he talks about new wine, he's talking about grape juice. It's unfermented. They would pour the juice into the wineskins, hang them up, and let them ferment. Well, as they ferment, they expand. Those bubbles creating the alcohol is there, and it's stretching the wineskins. That's fine for a new wineskin, but an old, already stretched wineskin will burst and lose everything. Jesus is trying to get across this idea. These old methods that you are using, These old, stretched out, tired, worn methods that started out fresh at one point and have become this caricature, this absurdity of itself, cannot in any way hold what I'm trying to give you right now. If you try to just patch this over and keep what you already have, you're going to be in worse shape than you were when you began. Everything needs to be made fresh. You can't just patch over this, bandage over the tumor, so to speak. There has to be a fundamental change occurring. Everything that you think you know about the law, about the legal system, about how acceptance only comes after the restoration, after the healing, after you've been made clean, all of that has to change. Or you will never get this good news that I'm trying to get across to you. This good news of how you're loved. This good news of how acceptance comes before all of that stuff. This is what Jesus is trying to get across with these patches and skins that he brings up right now. You can't mix the old with the new. We've been talking in here for some time now about the fact that the means that you use must match the ends that you seek. Think about that for just a second if you're hearing it for the first time. The means that you use must match the ends that we seek. Why? Because the means that we use always match the ends that we produce. The means that you use have already created the ends for you in this very moment. Spiritually speaking, in the lived moment, it's only means. There are no ends. Ends are out there imagined someplace, some outcome that we expect from what we're doing right now. They're not real. The only thing that exists is what's happening right here and right now. That's the means that we use. If the means that you seek spiritually are the unity and peace and contentment of true spiritual formation, then you will never reach that until you practice as your means unity and contentment and peace. The means that we use have everything to do with the ends that we seek and produce. This is what Jesus is trying to say. In his way, you can't mix the old and the new. You can't use these legal means, these severe means, these joyless means to get to this place of liberation and freedom and connection and celebration. It will never take you there because it's fear-based. Fear will only produce more fear, never love. Perfect love casts out the fear. But fear, this is the problem with our church trying to drive us into the arms of a loving God by using fear as method. It doesn't work. It only produces more fear, more of the sense that we are not worthy of the gift that is being offered to us. And it's here that I wanted to read you just a little passage. On Wednesday nights, we've been studying Brother Lawrence, and we hit the fifth letter last Wednesday that just had a passage in it that just struck me once again as we were reading it. And just listen for a second. Short passage here. Brother Lawrence is writing to a priest and trying to describe for him the amazing connection that he's found with his God. For Brother Lawrence, everything was about the practice of the presence of God. And he found that presence in everything that he did. As a cook in his abbey, he found God's presence in the kitchen as strongly as he did in the chapel in front of the Blessed Sacrament. And he realized that it was this seamless thing. But he was also getting flack from other people, obviously. So he writes to this priest to try to ask him, "What do you think about all of this?" And in one passage he says, "As for what passes in me at present, I cannot express it. I have no pain or difficulty about my state, because I have no will but that of God, which I endeavor to accomplish in all things, and to which I am so resigned that I would not take up a straw from the ground against his order, or from any other motive but purely that of love to him. I have quit all forms of devotion and set prayers, but those to which my state obliges me." See what he's doing? Institution takes the back seat to the presence of God. He follows the rule of his house, but only those rules that oblige him. Everything else has gone away. "And I make it my business only to persevere in his holy presence, wherein I keep myself by a simple attention and a general fond regard to God, which I may call an actual presence of God, or so to speak better, an habitual, silent, and secret conversation of the soul with God. which often causes in me joys and raptures inwardly, and sometimes also outwardly, so great that I am forced to use means to moderate them and prevent their appearances to others. In other words, like Steve Martin used to say, he had happy feet. He just couldn't contain himself, and he had to try to draw it in so that people wouldn't be distracted by his burst of absolute and abandonment and joy. In short, I am assured beyond all doubt that my soul has been with God above these 30 years. I pass over many things that I may not be tedious to you, yet I think it proper to inform you after what manner I consider myself before God, whom I behold as my King. I consider myself as the most wretched of all men, full of sores and corruption, and who has committed all sorts of crimes against his King, touched with a sensible regret. I confess to him all my wickedness. I ask his forgiveness. I abandon myself in his hands that he may do what he pleases with me. Oh my gosh. Okay, we can say, yeah, he's a 16th century Catholic and that's the way they thought. But look what he's saying here. I'm wretched, full of sores and corruption. I don't deserve this connection with God. But then he follows and says, this King, full of mercy and goodness, very far from chastising me, for all those horrible things that he's done and continues to do, embraces me with love, makes me eat at his table, serves me with his own hands, gives me the key of his treasures. He converses and delights himself with me incessantly in 1,000 and 1,000 ways and treats me in all respects as his favorite. It is thus I consider myself from time to time in his holy presence. He is God's favorite. And so am I, and so are you. God can have an infinite number of favorites and best friends and all of that. This paradox, this dichotomy is what I want you to take a look at right now. He has happy feet. He has so much joy internally that he can barely keep his arms and his legs still. He sees himself as sitting at God's table, being served by him. You know, the image of Jesus washing the feet of the disciples, God serving us, caring about us in that way, is what his experience of his God is. And yet at the same time, he's the most wretched of all men, full of sores and corruptions and regrets. How do you reconcile those two things? This is where I wanted to drive to in this message this morning. We started off talking about the secret of life. What is the secret of life? If it's more than just enjoying the passage of time, then I think it's right here. And it's right in what Jesus was trying to tell the Pharisees and the disciples of John. That there are two things that we consider as separate, that we consider as sort of an if-then statement. I am a wretched man, and if I will clean myself up, then I will be an accepted man or woman. And what Jesus is saying is, no, it doesn't work that way. What Brother Lawrence has learned to do, his genius, was to embrace two disparate things at the same time. To find the joy and the celebration and the connection with his God in spite of his wretchedness. And it really goes even further than that. It's because of his wretchedness that God singles him out and calls him to himself. I think the secret of life, to the happiness in life, to the experience of life that we all say that we want, contented, peaceful, full of meaning and purpose, is to be able to do this, to pull these two things together. A few weeks ago, I used a passage from Brené Brown, who was a social worker and a researcher who spent 10 years studying the social condition of humans. And what she learned after those 10 years was that it all comes down to connection. It's all about connection, she said. And there are basically two groups of people, those who connect and those who don't. And the line between the two of them is shame. And she defines shame as the fear of disconnection. And so if you look at the people who can connect, you know, they have certain characteristics about them. And she said the first characteristic was they had the courage to embrace their imperfection. Okay? They could embrace their imperfection. They had the courage to do that. And they also were okay being vulnerable. And not only were they okay and accepting of their vulnerability, but they saw their vulnerability as what made them beautiful, made them attractive and desirable. Now think for a second. Isn't it people's imperfection that give us the most affection for them? I mean, when you really think about it, even things that have happened, you know, those of you who are married, you know, if your ceremony goes perfect, that's one thing, and that's what we're all trying to do. We want to have the ceremony perfect, and we spend all this time and energy making it perfect. But it's the screw-ups, it's the things that go wrong that we're laughing about and remembering decades later. It's the things that go wrong. There's this movie that one kid's taking another one on an adventure. She's never had an adventure, and they're sneaking into a movie theater, and she says, "We could get in trouble for this." And he says, "Yeah, that's how you know it's an adventure. We're supposed to mess up. We're supposed to get in trouble. We're supposed to get our uniforms dirty. We're not supposed to live this life perfect, innocent, pure as the driven snow. We're here to mess up. We're here to get dirty. We're here to embrace the fact that we're imperfect and to realize that it's the imperfections that make us attractive, desirable. Someone that you believe is perfect, you've got them so high up on a pedestal you can't approach them. They are carved out of marble, you know? But when you see the imperfections and the chips, they suddenly become approachable. You can have friends with people like that. Can we embrace our imperfection? Can we see that it's our imperfection that makes us beautiful? Not only in each other's eyes, but in God's eyes. We are not created to be automatons, to be all exactly the same. God delights, takes pleasure in, it's his deepest purpose to interact with us as individuals in all of the different ways that we are imperfect. And because of that imperfection, we have an acceptance and a connection that we cannot lose. This is what Jesus is trying to get across. We think that Jesus' mission oftentimes was to eliminate sin in the world. That's what I was taught as a Catholic and as an evangelical. What I believe now is that Jesus' mission was to eliminate shame in the world. Because if he can eliminate the fear of disconnection, then that person has everything that he or she needs to move into the acceptance that will make them perfect in their connection with God. We don't seek perfection before acceptance. It's impossible to do. The only way it works is the other way around. Perfect love casts out fear. Fear doesn't cast out the love. Well, yes, it does, I guess. Fear doesn't take us to the love, is what I meant to say. We have to realize that we are accepted exactly as we are. Jesus called it good news. You know, the good news is there is no bad news. The good news is you have a Father who loves you right now as much as there could ever be love. And if you could just see that, everything changes. How do we see that? How do these people who believe that they are worthy of acceptance, of love, of connection, how did they get that way? How did they understand somehow deep enough in their souls that it changed the course of their lives? They had to experience acceptance and connection. It's the only way. You can't just think it. You can't just will yourself to know that you're accepted. You experience it, and you experience it over and over again until you know. Those of us who are lucky enough to have accepting people around us in spite of our flaws could get that from human connection and contact. Others of us who have not had that pleasure and that luxury can find it with our God and then can move it outward into our human relationships. But either way, that absolute connection is available to us if we will shed our skin, if we will shed those old garments, if we will let go of the things that we're holding on to legally, trying to control this whole system, let it go and put the new patch on, pour the new wine in, and find out from the inside out what it means to truly be in God's presence and love and acceptance, or as Jesus would say, his kingdom. Let's pray. Father, when stated that way, it just sounds so outrageous and so amazing. Speaking for myself, I'm so geared toward legal attitudes and trying to measure up and trying to, you know, toe the line and become acceptable. This has been a hard, hard lesson. And I'm sure it is for so many of us, and you know that. Help us to shed our skins. Help us to let go of the things that are just holding us back now. Whatever purpose they may have served in the past, whatever they may have brought us through, if now they are just holding us back, if now they are just weights around our neck, help us to have the courage to let them go, to accept our imperfections, to find beauty in the vulnerability that you find beauty in. We want to see through your eyes, Father. Help us to do that. Help us to let go of everything that stands in our way, so that each day we can say that we took another step closer to you, closer to the fullness of the contentment and the enjoyment that you designed us and created us to have in our lives. We love you, Father, because you first loved us. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. Let's all stand.